Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. In this episode, we'll hear from some people who are preserving and creating cultural traditions. While the word tradition might make you think of something that's consistent over time, it turns out that one of the most consistent things about traditions is how they adapt and evolve as they've passed from person to person.
Folklife is not history. It's not static. It's not defined. It's something that's always changing and always renewing itself.
So one of my favorite examples I've heard is the game of telephone. And the idea is that the last person who hears the sentence probably is going to hear something different than what the first person originally said. And in a way, that's folklife.
It's not just about the past either. We'll hear how even our social media habits are becoming a part of our Appalachian folkways. And we'll talk with Lady D, a blues and gospel singer in southern West Virginia, who's passionate about sharing the love of this style of music with others.
The first thing I usually ask kids is, what kind of music do you listen to? And they'll name all these different things. And of course, in this area, it's usually country. They say they listen to country, they like rock and roll, or they like hip hop. And then when I say, well, this all came from blues, they don't believe me.
Those stories and more coming up Inside Appalachia.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, bringing food from your local neighborhood farmer to you at West Virginia Farmers Markets. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Life these days is fast-paced. Often, I'm so rushed in the morning getting myself and my family ready, I don't get a chance to slow down and enjoy some of my favorite hobbies. The simple pleasure of eating handmade biscuits and gravy, building a campfire, or teaching my kids to make some of the foods my grandparents taught me, or just stealing away to listen to some of my favorite hip-hop or country music. Those special expressions of culture and the ways we share them with others, also known as folklife, that's what we're talking about today. West Virginia State folklorist Emily Hilliard defines it like this.
So we think about folklife as the art of everyday life, so behavior that we learn by living our lives rather than through formal training that we pass on from person to person. You might learn from your grandmother watching her in the kitchen or through sitting knee to knee and learning from person to person. Although now we know that you can also learn folklife through the internet and YouTube videos. But we're really looking at how culture moves in a community.
Emily says folklife can take on many different forms in our everyday lives.
Another definition I like to use is the way a group expresses itself creatively. So that could be in food ways, in dance, in music, in language, jokes, dress, material culture, customs. And I like that definition because it emphasizes that folklife is not just big A art, folk art, traditional art.
And we recently launched a new initiative called the Inside Appalachia's Folkways Project, which will expand our reporting to include more stories within six states of this region. In this time of economic transition in parts of Central Appalachia, we're especially excited to learn more about the process of traditional Appalachian crafts. And Caitlin Tan moved literally across the country to join the Inside Appalachia team. Caitlin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Caitlin, what was it about West Virginia and this job that made you move across the country?
Well, I was raised in Pinedale, Wyoming. It's a town with a population of less than 2,000 people, and it's at the base of the Rocky Mountains. So, although I'd never been to West Virginia, the state honestly felt quite familiar already. It was important to me to move somewhere with lots of outdoors in rural towns, and I really loved the community of a small town. As for the job itself, it felt like the perfect fit. Over the past 6 years, I've reported on everything from breaking news to longer form feature stories. And I've always kind of preferred the latter, working on stories that highlight the people of a community. And so in a lot of ways, that's exactly what this folklife reporter job is all about.
And you mentioned you were looking for someplace with rural communities. What is it that you love about a small town? That's just not usually something you hear from young folks these days, it seems.
Well, I love being able to go to the grocery store and have that be your social hour. And I love the feeling that everyone's your family and kind of has your back.
Mm-hmm. Well, That's definitely a similarity that we have here. You came from the Rockies to the Appalachian Mountains. What are some of the differences and similarities in that?
Quite a few similarities, actually. As I mentioned earlier, both states are rural, and both states' economies depend on coal. In fact, I was looking up, Wyoming is the top producer of coal in the country right now.
Oh, really? So do you all have, like, the same kind of cultural connection to coal as we have here in West Virginia and Central Appalachia? We see the Friends of Coal stickers everywhere in this place. Do you see that, too? I mean, since Wyoming is the top producer?
To be honest, Wyoming is a really huge state when it comes to landmass, and the coal part of the state is in the northeastern part of the state, and I'm from the northwestern part. So to be honest, I really wasn't even aware of how big of a deal coal was in the state.
Okay.
I know it definitely does impact our economy, but I would say coal plays a much bigger role here in West Virginia. In Wyoming, there's a big emphasis from the natural gas industry, actually. I would say that plays even a bigger role in the culture.
Oh, okay. And any other similarities or differences?
Yeah. I mean, just the culture in general of both states, they're very proud of their culture. Back home, it's all about the Western cowboy culture. I grew up moving cows on ranches, and I was even rodeo queen in high school. So out here, I've really observed a beautiful mountain culture as well. There's pride in traditional food and also knowing how to work with your hands. And that's something that's really important in Wyoming as well and really important to me. The only differences that stand out a lot is just, like I said, Wyoming is bigger in landmass, and you might see a few more cowboy hats and horse trailers.
Oh, okay. So your new job is folklife reporter. As you've begun digging into the types of stories you'd like to do, what have you learned so far about folklife? What is it? How do you define it? And what does it mean to be a folklife reporter for Inside Appalachia?
Well, it's been kind of an evolving definition for me. I've been lucky enough to spend quite a bit of time with folklorists in the region. And from what I understand, folklife is really all around us. We often think of it as something that's in the past or a very traditional craft. And it is those things, but it can be more than that as well. Essentially, folklife is a tradition that's been shared or passed down within a community, and it can even be reinterpreted. So one of my favorite examples I've heard is the game of telephone. So if you're not familiar, it's essentially one person whispering a sentence to another person, and then that person whispers what they think they heard to another person, and it goes on and on. And the idea is that the last person who hears the sentence probably is going to hear something different than what the first person originally said. And in a way, that's folklife. It's something being shared amongst a group of people, and those people are reinterpreting it in their own way. So when it comes to my job, I focus a little more on material culture. So it's essentially a subgroup of folklife. And my stories typically revolve around things you can tangibly hold in your hand, like a piece of pottery or a painting or even food. But I also get to report on music and dancing as well.
I feel like Appalachia has such special stories and unique stories to tell, and it seems like folklife reporting is such a great fit for this show, because while there's baseball everywhere, when you find baseball or something like that that's familiar with the rest of the country, there's something unique about when you find those things here in Appalachia. So, and that's a great way of explaining it. And, you know, I've said this several times on the show, too. I've lived in southern West Virginia my whole life. I'd imagine that some things might stand out to you a bit more than they do to me. Do you think that you might notice things about the state that locals are accustomed to?
I think it's definitely possible. Everything out here is really new and exciting to me. When I first moved out here, I'd never tried a pepperoni roll, and now it's my favorite thing. So these past 6 months, I've spent a lot of time reporting in northern and central West Virginia, and this summer, I'm really hoping to spend a little more time shining a light on artisans in southern West Virginia. But as for your question, I think one of my favorite examples is the recent story I did featuring a father and son-in-law duo who build furniture in a small town outside of Charleston. Although they're proud of their skill sets, they never really talked much about how the father had taught the son-in-law the craft. And so by me coming out and just asking them some questions, it was really great to watch that interaction and watch them kind of discover these connections that had been there all along.
And certainly beauty in everyday life that we might not have recognized. And
And that's, I think that's part of our hope for this project, too, and for your reporting. There has been talk about this region, about having a sense of fatalism and seeing no hope, perhaps, with a lot of the poverty rates. We know about the opioid epidemic and things like that that we struggle with here in Central Appalachia and West Virginia. And some people will argue, well, we're not fatalistic. We don't have those perspectives. But I do think that it depends on what your reality is at that time. If you've been struggling for years, then it might be hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel. So as a person who's not from this area, it's great to hear your perspective in helping, I think, some of us here to continue to recognize the beauty in everyday life here. So, and that story was really beautiful. When Caitlin first came to West Virginia, she began to explore our culture and folk life. In West Virginia, she found pepperoni rolls, ramps, and mountaineers. Even Bigfoot and Mothman were often symbols of the state. Then Caitlin met a graphic artist in Morgantown who has built a successful design business by reinterpreting some of those beloved local treasures with a modern cartoonish flair. Here's Folklife reporter Caitlin Tan with the story.
Liz Pavlovic's studio is nestled in a bright corner of her living room. Everything is colorful and quirky, like Liz herself. She sports a rainbow-hued t-shirt, a Mothman tattoo, and bright purple hair. A doll head that looks like Liz sits on the windowsill.
This is you.
Yeah. I found that in a thrift store. I was really? Like, well, I can't not buy it. Yeah.
But what stands out the most is Liz's art. On her computer screen is a work in progress featuring two West Virginia monsters. Below the illustration are the words, "Not all who lurk are lost."
That's a new poster I'm working on.
And it's Mothman, right?
Yeah, Mothman and Flatwoods Monster, who I have hanging out together in a lot of my stuff. They're kind of like the best friends of the group, I guess.
Liz keeps stockpiles of her artwork on her bookshelves, neatly organized. She's become somewhat of a West Virginia celebrity for her state-themed graphic designs. Her art is mostly featured on pins, stickers, and posters. There's a food collection, including pawpaws, apple butter, ramps, buckwheat cakes, and pepperoni rolls, which are a bit controversial. Her design includes cheese, which for pepperoni roll purists is not traditional.
I think the next run of pepperoni roll pens, I might remove the cheese because there's been some debate on that.
Another popular design is her West Virginia hot dog, or better known as the slaw dog. It's topped with mustard, chili, coleslaw, and onions, something that's only loved below what's known as the slaw line, or everything south of milepost 111 on Interstate 79.
Yeah, occasionally people will come to my table when I'm vending and see the slaw dog stuff, and they're like, oh, that's disgusting. And like, people get really heated about it, like maybe more than the pepperoni roll thing with me, yeah.
Some of Liz's favorite designs are the area's cryptids, or animals from legends that may or may not exist, like Bigfoot. But Liz likes to focus on more unique and local characters, such as the Flatwoods Monster, named for the West Virginia town where it was sighted.
I believe it was like the 50s when it was seen in the woods there by some people who saw like bright yellow eyes, and I guess it had like a coppery smell.
Often her cards and posters will feature cryptids with a pun, like her headless Grafton Monster Valentine's card that reads, "I'm headless over heels for you."
It was a news reporter that supposedly saw him in Grafton, West Virginia, and he described him as being like 6 feet tall, 4 feet wide, I believe, with seal skin and, like, basically no head.
Those descriptions might sound creepy, but Liz's designs render these monsters as adorable oddities. Her Mothman is a fuzzy black being that is often doing everyday activities, like surfing the web or riding a bike. On one sticker, Liz includes the words, "Live, laugh, lurk," with Mothman confidently laying on his side.
Sort of a model, like, sassy pose, maybe like some people say, draw me one of your French girls pose.
Liz studied graphic design at WVU and graduated in 2010, but it wasn't until 2 years ago she opened her own business. The pepperoni roll pin was the first design she sold. She grew up in Alabama, but as a child, she visited family every year in West Virginia. Liz says she's always felt connected to the state.
I just like grew up, you know, eating pepperoni rolls. My mom made them at home even when we lived in Alabama and stuff. So I guess there was just a big part of my life that was West Virginia that I didn't even really realize was.
It took about a year for Liz's business to take off. At first, she says she was just trying to break even. But after 2 years, she says her art sales make up her income. She does half of her art sales through her online store. Liz's sales follow a national trend. According to the Hiscox Online Art Trade Report, a little less than half of art buyers choose to purchase their art online, which is in itself more than a $4 billion industry. Something that was unimaginable even just 10 years ago.
Instagram has been a huge part of it for me personally because there are a lot of artists on there and just a big community, and it's easy to share your like visual stuff on there, obviously.
Instagram launched in 2010, and today the majority of art galleries say Instagram is the best way to promote their art. Even more, the majority of consumers under 35 say Instagram is how they discover new artists. Liz has a lot of fans. She has a respectable 2,836 followers on Instagram. And one of those fans is Candace Nelson, the author of the West Virginia Pepperoni Roll book.
So anytime I see any art or products or anything even remotely related to the pepperoni roll, I get really excited.
So naturally, she fell in love with Liz's pepperoni roll collection. One of her favorites is the Valentine's Day cards.
One of them said, like, pep rolls before bros, and I thought that was really funny.
Liz also sells her work in boutiques and tourism shops around West Virginia and Ohio, but she also does a lot of in-person vending. Tonight, it's at the music show at Morgantown's Retroteque store. Several bands are playing, including the local punk rock duo Haggard Wolf. Liz watches the show from her art booth. It's a long table filled with all of her stickers, pins, t-shirts, posters, and twinkling lights weave through all the items. People of all ages stop by her booth. One young boy named Devlin purchases a bedazzled Mothman pin.
The one that says Moth Glam Edition. The
nice.
Mothman.
What about it made it stand out to you?
I like Mothman, so I like sparkly things.
It's through the little designs on pins, cards, and stickers that Liz is able to capture a part of West Virginian culture. Candace, the pepperoni roll fan, says Liz's art takes traditional West Virginian things and adds a sense of humor.
I love that she kind of draws on these almost inside jokes that we have as West Virginians and turns it into something beautiful. So I like that it's almost as though you have to be in on it. You have to know West Virginia culture to be able to really, truly appreciate it.
And Liz says she hopes to keep up with it. The motto for her business is, keep on creeping on. This spring, be on the lookout for her newest cryptid, the Ogwa. You can supposedly find the 500-pound serpentine creature swimming in the Monongahela River. Or, of course, you could simply go to Liz's online shop. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Morgantown, West Virginia.
And if you want in on more of those inside West Virginia jokes Caitlin was talking about, we've posted links on our website to our stories about pepperoni rolls, the Dingus Tunnel, the Greenbrier Ghost, and more local lore. You can also find a list of town names and how they got their names. Ever wonder how the town Big Ugly West Virginia or Hot Lips Kentucky got their names? You can find those stories and more at wvpublic.org. There, you can also subscribe to the Inside Appalachia podcast. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll travel to a town that's reinventing itself through art. We'll also hear from gospel and blues singer Lady D and how the music she sings influenced country and rock and roll. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu. Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping farmers share their food with your family every week at your local farmers market. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Our next story asks whether traditional art can help reinvent our economy. One small town is trying a bit of an experiment to find out. Greensboro is a small town in southern Pennsylvania just across the West Virginia border. It sits on the banks of the Monongahela River, surrounded by small hills and patches of trees. In years past, the town has weathered the boom and bust of a pottery industry, river trade, and coal. Lately, it's been more bust than boom. But now, some artists are trying to stimulate the local economy using what they know best, creativity. Our Folklife reporter Caitlin Tan visited the Greensboro Art Cooperative to find out more.
Walking down the streets of Greensboro, it feels a bit like a ghost town. There are houses, business signs, a post office, but only two cars drive by in 10 minutes and no one is walking the streets. But the quiet atmosphere abruptly changes when I walk into the former ice cream parlor turned music shop. The entire room is filled with artwork and antiques. There's a stone chair shaped like a hand, porcelain dolls lining the bookcases, and a boar's head hanging near the ceiling. Live music fills the room. That's Shane McManus and his friends Nico Kreider and Evan Collins playing an impromptu jam. It's an old-time Appalachian tune called Waterbound. The music shop is one of the three buildings that are part of the Greensboro Art Cooperative, a nonprofit art collective that's organized by McManus. He's a West Virginia native who spent his life immersed in music and arts. Now at 31 years old, McManus is trying to use his love of the arts to revive the town.
Our goal is to preserve the past but promote the future. And so through using what the past has given us and lent us, then we can create really beautiful art and also a sense of community and pride in our small Appalachian towns, which in my opinion is really diminishing.
The co-op not only provides a space for artists to sell their work, but it's a space for them to create. There's a wood shop, a bike shop, pottery room, music room, painting area. Anything an artist wants to do, there's likely a tool for it. Members pay a $200 lifetime membership or the equivalent in labor, and profits from wares made at the co-op are split 50-50 with the artist. McManus says the goal is for the co-op to be a centerpiece for Greensboro, where the population is down to 249 people. He wants the co-op to be a reason for people to come visit and a reason for people to stay.
Getting them to see hope where there was none, and that's why people leave to find greener pastures.
Greensboro was once a thriving town with a rich artisan history, and it was originally settled by German glassblowers in the 1700s. It's also right on the Monongahela River, so it was part of a major river trading route. Greensboro's mayor, Katie Sills, says she's heard stories of the early days when a hotel stood right by the river.
At one point, you know, a circus came down the river and they had an elephant in the lobby of the hotel. So it was a fairly booming and bustling town.
In the 1800s, the first large-scale pottery operation opened up in Greensboro. The wet, muddy soil near the river creates rich clay perfect for pottery.
A lot of these New Geneva or Greensboro pots that you'll see on like Antiques Roadshow that go for $30,000, $40,000, they were made right here.
In fact, it's not rare to find 200-year-old pottery today. The co-op has preserved an original kiln used by settlers. But as artisans moved away and trade moved away from rivers, Greensboro became less relevant. It made a slight comeback in the coal industry in the mid-1900s, but Sill says that too has disappeared.
Some buildings have kind of fallen into disrepair or been torn down. There are not really many businesses left in the town.
And in some ways, Greensboro is not that different than many small Appalachian towns, where the coal industry that was once a driving force of economies is now declining. And so this leaves many towns without a sustainable economy, much like Greensboro. This is something that Tim Ezel studies. He's a research scientist at the University of Kentucky, and he focuses on asset-based development. Here's how he explains it.
using the assets you have at hand or at your disposal, what your community already has in place, your local talents, your local resources, your local skills, your local art, your local heritage, and using those to create economic opportunities for people in your community.
Ezell says concepts like the co-op can grow a town, but it has to be done realistically. As in, it's not cheap, it can take many years, it needs momentum, and most importantly, the local community has to be accepting of change.
Change is hard, and you have to be willing to accept change in order to move forward. We have some communities that can't change, and because of that, they aren't going anywhere.
And Mayor Sill says the town is ready for that change.
We're all really hopeful that we'll get that next wave of whatever that wave would be, you know, something new to bring a little bit of bustle into the town. I don't know if it's ever going to be quite the same, but each phase has been different.
And the co-op is relying on local assets to try to bring about that next wave. Members are fixing up old storefronts to use as studios. They're using local clay to create art, and they're using local tools.
Everything is donation. All of our resources have been found, donated, upcycled, and recycled. So it's really amazing what you can put together just with what you find around.
As for operational costs, McManus has been quite fortunate. His father, Keith McManus, has funded most of the co-op. Keith was the former mayor of the town, and he's something of a musical legend in the region because of his involvement in the old-time music community over the years. People can be assets too, and in many ways, Keith himself is one of the town's greatest resources. Because of the financial cushion and Keith's arts and music connections, Shane says there's not a push for artists to mass produce or to even sell their work, but rather just focus on creating art.
Our goal is to stay within a tri-county, if not a tri-state area. We don't really want to branch out in terms of what we sell too much farther than that, like on the internet and things like that. So we've purposely kind of withheld that for a long time just to kind of keep our wares locally.
Over the past 8 years, the co-op has renovated Greensboro's old abandoned theater into a studio space. And it has 65 members, some from the Appalachian region and others from across the world. Connections McManus has made through work in the music and arts industry. He says the co-op has given some of these artists a reason to either stay or come back to create in Appalachia.
So many of my peers and friends that have had to go and move out of the state, out of Appalachia, where they're from, just to find a studio.
So artists come and go throughout the year, whether it's for an impromptu jam, to fix their bicycle, or to make their next piece of pottery. And when they come, Mayor Sill says,
they breathe just that little bit of extra life into the town when they're there.
The future goal for the co-op is for artists to work and live there. But right now it's not fully developed. The studio spaces are a little rough around the edges, and the storefront is still more of a working space. McManus hopes to renovate two buildings into a coffee shop and restaurant. But he says it takes time. It takes time to create change, to bring Greensboro's artisan history forward into the modern day. And it also takes a vision, like the ability to find strengths and assets in unlikely places.
I mentioned earlier in today's show that Caitlin's reporting on folk life is part of a new initiative here at Inside Appalachia. Caitlin isn't the only new voice you'll hear on Inside Appalachia in the coming months. 10 people recently joined what we're calling the Inside Appalachia Folkways Reporting Corps. We were shocked and delighted to see how many people applied for these positions, and it was tough to select only 10. Some are journalists already, others are storytellers in their own way. They live in North Carolina, Virginia, Kentucky, and West Virginia. We brought everyone together recently for a training in Southern West Virginia. Journalists do things differently than folklorists, and vice versa. As the two styles got together for training, we discovered that folklorists and journalists also have some common ground. As a journalist, there's something really cool about being in a room full of people and learning about each other's interview styles and techniques. We also went over the technical stuff, recording interviews and producing them from the field. And we talked a lot about why we all do what we do and why storytelling matters. Here's how one Folkways Corps member described his hopes for the project.
It's going to allow Inside Appalachia to dig deep in Appalachian culture in a way that you can only do if you get a big, diverse group of people. It's going to result in a lot of really cool stories that listeners are going to appreciate.
That's Zach Harold, one of the new Folkways reporters. He's also the managing editor of West Virginia Living and Wonderful West Virginia magazines. A lot of the stories he writes about in his day job also touch on folk life, but he told me he's always been interested in learning radio too. And the training, Zach says, gave him a whole new perspective on what folk life means.
Folk life is not history. It's not static. It's not defined. It's something that's always changing and always renewing itself.
There are two folklorists on the team. One of them, Nicole Musgrave, lives in Southeast Kentucky.
As a folklorist, I'm really interested in the ways that people creatively express themselves in their everyday lives and kind of shining a spotlight onto some things that maybe go unnoticed or unrecognized and trying to kind of amplify some of those stories and lift them up.
Nicole also believes journalism and folklore are a natural fit.
From the ethnographer, folklorist point of view, you know, our training tells us to be in places for long periods of times and to get to know communities and kind of understand the nuances about those places. And so I think that the folklorist perspective can add that nuance and can bring about that kind of long-term understanding about different communities in a way that kind of fly-in, fly-out journalists don't always capture.
Since the training, we've heard some great story ideas. Each reporter will pitch us folklife stories from a community in their state, and you can listen to them here on Inside Appalachia in the coming year. Here's our producer, Roxy Todd.
We are a small team. It's a labor of love for us. Now we have more people that will be sending us stories and helping us continue to tell Appalachia's story from across Central Appalachia.
The inaugural class of the Folkways Reporting Corps includes reporters from four different states. In West Virginia, Corps members include Lexi Browning, Zach Harold, Chris Williams, Jordan Lovejoy, and Heather Nyday. We also welcome Mason Adams and Jeremy Farley from Virginia, Rachel Green and Sarah Lynch Thomason from North Carolina, and Nicole Musgrave from Kentucky. Our first partner for this initiative is the West Virginia Folklife Program, a project of the West Virginia Humanities Council. Now we're looking for more partners with a passion for Appalachia and storytelling, possibly other folklife programs, in Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, Ohio, or Virginia. The next phase of this project will take us across the ocean to explore the British Isles and the connections to Central Appalachian folklife. To help us with this project, we're looking for a West Virginia high school teacher with audio, digital editing, and writing experience. If you know of an energetic teacher who might be interested in partnering, send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. So here's a question I've been pondering. What role does folklife have for us in our modern world? How does it fit into our already busy and frankly quite stressful lives? For an answer to that and how folklife and folklore can help us reimagine our future, I turn once again to West Virginia State folklorist Emily Hilliard.
So Henry Glassy, another folklorist, says that folklore is the creation of the future out of the past. So in order to kind of know where we're headed, we have to know about these traditions in the past. And also, you know, if we're thinking about the way communities are sharing, are communicating and sharing culture, that's really how it's happening in the present day. It comes out of a tradition that is of the past, but it is very much moving forward. And so folk life always has to evolve. So it's not really some kind of historical relic. It's actually about how people experience and use culture in the present day in their daily lives.
For most of us, digital life is part of daily life. Emily says folklore is even present in our social media interactions.
The Library of Congress now is archiving memes, and a lot of folklorists, people call themselves digital folklorists, and are looking at the way community is being created online, and that could be in groups like Ravelry, which is a knitters group online, or Facebook groups. And then also the way memes are this kind of community-based tradition that is created by everyday people, is shared, and then has all these different variations And then a meme, you know, if you think of the definition of meme, not as the digital image, but just as a sort of idea or almost a stereotype that's kind of this codified statement that has cultural bearing. So a great way to look at how culture is being shared today is on the internet.
One of our new reporters with the Folkway Corps is a self-taught expert on Appalachian storytelling in digital spaces. Jeremy Farley grew up in Wythe County, Virginia, and is the founder of a popular blog called Appalachian Magazine. Jeremy's family is originally from Mingo County, West Virginia, and growing up, he loved listening to their stories. He never expected that one day he'd be able to quit his full-time job in order to share those stories with the rest of the world. I sat down with Jeremy recently to talk about Appalachian Magazine and his new position as a member of the Folkways Reporting Corps. Where did you get this idea to create Appalachian Magazine?
Around 2013, my great-grandfather was dying of old age, and I just realized that, you know, it was time for somebody to pen these stories that he had told my whole life, and I wanted my children to know them. And so I started just a very, very simple blog telling stories of Appalachia and telling stories that my grandfather had given me. And to my astonishment, you know, we got 10 subscribers that evening. Then the next day we had 50 subscribers. And within just a couple months' time, we had thousands of people who had subscribed to get our online articles about Appalachia. And little did I realize there was something bigger in the works there. And today, about 5 or 6 years later, I was able to quit my job and work full-time with Appalachian Magazine. And so we exist now in a print and online publication, have 160,000 Facebook fans, and it's just fascinating to me. Each week we're reaching 250,000 people. A few years into it, we started doing a demographic study to figure out where our readers are from and who was actually reading the publication. Up to that point, most of our articles had been geared toward West Virginia. To my astonishment, North Carolina, Ohio, and Florida were where all of our readers were coming from for the most part. And what we chalked that up to being was where West Virginia has seen such a mass exodus over the last couple of decades. There are a lot of people who have left the state, but they still feel a connection to home. And my mother always joked about my dad. Anytime he would see somebody with a WV on the back of their car getting gas, he would knock people over trying to get to them and spend the next hour comparing West Virginia stories. And so West Virginia is one of those places that even though you might leave it, it never leaves you.
Could you pull up one of those stories that your grandfather shared that helped to gain such momentum back in the beginning?
Sure. My grandfather, one thing that he was always adamant about was planting by the signs. And, you know, for some of the people that might not be familiar with that, it is planting your garden based upon the phases of the moon. And so I dug a little bit into that. And from my grandfather telling me the stories about planting by the signs, I started studying that and just found that to be very incredible. I'm still one of these hobby gardeners, and I always say next year I'm going to plant by the signs. But my gardens never turn out, so maybe I should try that next year.
Nice. That's great. Why do you think that there's been such interest in Appalachian culture, so much, in fact, that you could, you know, quit your day job and work full-time on this dream of yours?
You cannot pick up anything that's related to Appalachia these days and it not have some political bend to it. And I think people are sick of politics. I know I am. And sometimes I go to these conferences and I go to these organizations and sit down and discuss Appalachia. And I'm the guy in the back who's secretly Googling what the words are that are being floated around at the table. And for us, we just speak in plain English. And we found an audience for that. We're nonpartisan, nonpolitical. Couldn't care less about who's in the White House or anything like that. We're just writing stories about pocket knives and biscuits.
And speaking of pocket knives, one article in particular that stood out to me that I could relate to was called The Kind of Men Who Carry Pocket Knives. And my daddy was always the kind of man who carried a pocket knife. And you'd always ask him, "Hey, Dad, you got your knife on you?" And he'd say, "Do I got my breeches on?" I really enjoyed this one. What inspired you to write this particular article?
As I recall, I was sitting in the library that day, and I saw a man and a woman come in, and the woman said to her husband, "Give me your pocket knife." And immediately, my eyes raised up, and I looked up, and he was a man that looked about like my father and looked about like the men that I grew up with. And as I was sitting there, and you know, for them, it was just a something that took place that they didn't give any thought after. But for me, it kind of brought me back to my childhood, and it put me back in Moore's Gun Shop, was a place in Graham's Forge where I actually, I guess I learned to be a man in that gun shop, just sitting at the feet of my father and sitting alongside all of his buddies. And they told stories that probably shouldn't be repeated on radio, but sitting in there as a child, all of those men had one thing in common, and that was that they carried a pocket knife. And my dad, he would clean a carburetor with his pocket knife and wipe it off on his jeans, and then the next afternoon he would be cutting an apple with that same pocket knife. And at Christmas time, his pocket knife was in high demand because it was the knife that was opening everybody's plastic Christmas presents.
And it's interesting, too, I have to point out, it did say the type of men, and I certainly can relate to it because it was my father who carried the pocket knife. But I shared this article on social media, and I noticed that the people who were commenting were also women who carried pocket knives, too.
I got a lot of people that messaged me on that very article saying, well, hey, women carry pocket knives, too. And as I got to thinking about that, I think that sums up the women of Appalachia. We carry a pocket knife, and we're going to let you know about it as well. And so I liked that, and I appreciated all of them for letting me know that they're still carrying pocket knives, too. And so best advice I have for anyone is if you need a pocket knife, it might be good to go for the woman with the big purse right now.
Could you read some of this article?
Though less than 40 years have passed, I am astonished to see just how drastic the world has changed from the time I was a small boy. Some of these changes have been for the better, but others, just to put it bluntly, I'm not so sure about. Yes, technology, vehicles, and even our day-to-day lives are a far cry from the world, from how the world was only a generation ago. But when I survey the changing landscape of America, the greatest change I see is found in the people themselves. Coming to age in the farming communities of rural Southwest Virginia, I was privileged to cut my teeth inside a John Deere tractor cab, seated alongside my father as he spread silage to over 100 hungry Black Angus cattle. As much as these experiences helped mold me into the person I am today, it was the people I grew up around who instilled in me a deep appreciation for all things Appalachia. When we weren't farming, my father and I could most likely be found in a local gun shop owned by one of my dad's friends, where I'd be seated on a bar stool alongside a half dozen other men who were drinking coffee while I sipped on a 25-cent can of Coca-Cola. Though I can't for the life of me remember a single one of these stories that were shared around that gun shop, which might be a good thing, I remember even as a 5-year-old thinking that they were often a little too far-fetched to be precisely true. Whether it was Billy, Jimmy, or a woolly fella I simply knew as Big Red, one thing that each of these men had in common was that they were tougher than a $2 steak, and they'd call a doctor before they'd ever think of calling a repairman, and they'd only call a doctor when they were on the doorstep of death. If they couldn't fix it, it probably couldn't be fixed.
You got to quit your day job and pursue your passion. You're also a part of the Inside Appalachia Folklife Reporting Corps. Why did you decide to take on the Inside Appalachia Reporting Corps as well?
You know, as a storyteller, I think one thing that attracted me so much to this opportunity was that it would be a bigger microphone. And as storytellers, I think that one thing we all have in common is that we're always looking for a bigger microphone so that way we can tell our story to a larger audience. And for me, I feel like I almost feel a sense of responsibility, and I feel like I've been tapped to tell the stories of people I grew up with. And, you know, the people I grew up with, they didn't realize that they had any story to tell for them. You know, they were very, very unassuming people, and they were just going through their day-to-day life. Little did they realize the stories they held and the stories that they hold on to are precious, and they're of a dying generation. And so for me, it's a great honor to just be able to tell the stories of people I grew up with, people that were farmers, people that never wore a suit and tie, people that never pronounced words that are 5 or 6 syllables long. For them, they were just interested in surviving the day and waking up the next morning and putting in an honest day's work and telling their stories to their children and hoping that maybe their grandchildren might listen. And little did they realize that here we are in 2019, and those stories that they told at the dinner table are in high demand and precious.
And what was your perception or thoughts about folk life before you started with this program? Did you realize that you were doing folk life and sharing folk life?
I'm a very, very simple person, and as far as folk life and folklore and all of the collegiate language is describing, I don't give that any thought. I just tell stories.
Jeremy, thank you so much for joining the Corps and for what you do with Appalachian Magazine and for your time on the show today.
Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to work with you.
Did you ever fall in love with a man that was no good? Did you ever fall in love with a man that was no good?
What you're hearing right now are the soulful sounds of Doris Fields, known as Lady D, an R&B, soul, and blues musician and songwriter living in Beckley. She's a daughter of a coal miner. Her dad moved to West Virginia from Alabama at 10 years old and spent 50 years in the mines. She says music has been in her blood since she was a young girl, growing up in Cabin Creek, West Virginia.
I've always wanted to be a singer since I tell people, I remember being 3 years old, and literally every Saturday, me and my grandmother would watch American Bandstand. And when I saw American Bandstand, I knew that's what I want to do. Of course, I started out singing in church like just about everybody else, but R&B was always what I loved growing up.
Lady D is a performer and a working artist with a passion for singing the blues. So much, in fact, that she's written a play about the one and only Bessie Smith. Smith was the most popular female blues singer of the 1920s and 1930s, earning the nickname the Empress of the Blues.
I love Chicago blues, and I talk about classic blues a lot because that was the Bessie Smith era in the 20s and 30s when women were really out front in the blues, and they wore the fancy costumes and everything. And
the play is a one-woman show called The Lady and the Empress, in which Lady D takes on the persona of Smith to bring that music to a new generation. She's been doing her one-woman show for 17 years now.
I learn new things about Bessie all the time, and she's a great inspiration to me. We've been together all this time, and like, you know, it's sort of interchangeable. I forget sometimes saying, you know, that she is me and I'm her.
For some, the blues might seem old-fashioned, but Lady D loves to share the connections between the blues and modern styles of music, like R&B and country, or even rock and roll.
The first thing I usually ask kids is, what kind of music do you listen to? And they all name all these different things. And of course, in this area, it's usually country. They say they listen to country, they like rock and roll, or they like hip hop. And then when I say, well, this all came from blues, they don't believe me. And then we'll get to talking about it. And I'll, you know, we'll do a couple of exercises around how blues was, I don't want to say invented, but how it was created. And then kids, they get it right away.
She breaks down songs to show students chord progressions and rhythms from blues songs and show them how the same riffs show up in rock, pop, and country music. This year, Lady D participated in the West Virginia Humanity Council's Folklife Apprenticeship Program, which connects emerging artists to mentors in their tradition. Lady D was paired up with gospel singer Xavier Oglesby of Beckley. She told us that at one time, Christians called the music, like the blues, the devil's music because of its secular themes. But Lady D and Xavier often found more similarities than differences between gospel and the blues. Revisiting some of the old songs they learned in church growing up, they found reminders and refrains of the so-called devil's music.
It wasn't so much me teaching Xavier anything about blues, but we were sort of reminding each other about where we both came from. Like I said, he's a great gospel singer. He comes from a family of ministers, and he's a minister himself. But he also, his family, his own juke joints. We don't see a lot of that distinction that people make, you know, between like blues is devil's music and, you know, gospel is God's music, and it's all God's music.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Now, we ain't sung this in a long time now. But now I dangers tossed and snares I have already come to a
That was Xavier and Lady D singing together. And we'll close out the show with a blues song Lady D wrote.
West Virginia, back on Cabin Creek, lived a woman, Lord, that woman could sing. She was 35, wild as a woman could be.
On today's show, we heard West Virginia State folklorist Emily Hilliard explain that folklife is how a particular culture expresses itself creatively in everyday life, whether that's through music, food, dress, customs, or any number of other ways. And as we've been discussing, our folkways change and adapt in exciting ways as they pass from person to person and bump up against new forms of digital expression. Our Folklife Corps members come from different backgrounds and perspectives, which we hope will make for an even richer telling of Appalachia's stories on the show. So stay tuned over the next few years as our Folkways Corps report back on what they're finding as they dig into the beauty of everyday life in our region. Until next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Lady D, Dinosaur Burps, John R. Miller, Spencer Elliott, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Catherine Moore edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Xander Alloy helps us with promotions. Special thanks to the West Virginia Folklife Program, a project of the West Virginia Humanities Council. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org to sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter. On our website, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
We could walk to the other side of this town. We could drive to the border of the sea. This place has everything from cars and bars to magazines, but it never seems to be enough for the restless side of me. My roots are in my boots, and they're taking me along with them wherever they may go. We got thrusters all on full, time to let myself be pulled. Ain't a plot of land that I can call my home. We could sink to the bottom of a storm drain, or a well in a yard of perfect green. I know sinking like I know swimming, I wouldn't cut out for easy living. I'm gonna burn the biggest trail you and your friends have ever seen. My roots are in my boots, and they're taking me along with them wherever they may go. We got thrusters all on.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia,
with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.